A little while ago, I think it might have been because he was 90, there was quite a few programmes about David Attenborough. And you know, he has obviously lived an extraordinary life. One of the things he did as a relatively young man was go out into what were then fairly unknown parts of the world and collect animals for zoos. And obviously discovered lots of animals that had hitherto been undiscovered. And he was saying in this interview about these expeditions that one of the hardest animals they discovered to catch was the ring-tailed monkey. But they had tried, the expedition had tried a number of ways to collect these monkeys, and basically the monkeys were just too clever, and they always evaded their escape. And then they got talking to some of the locals, some of the Zulus, and the native Zulus explained how to do it, because they had been collecting and catching this agile animal with ease for years. And well, the method that the Zulus told David Attenborough the team was based on their knowledge of the monkey. And their trap was very simple. It was nothing more than a melon, one of those great big African melons, growing on a vine. And the monkeys love the seeds of the melon. So knowing this, the Zulus simply cut a hole in the melon, just large enough for the monkey to insert his little paw in and to reach the seeds inside. The monkey sticks his paw in, grabs as many seeds as he can, and then starts to withdraw it. But he can't get his paw, clutching so many seeds now, out of the hole. His fist is larger than the hole. The monkey pulls and tugs and screeches and fights with the melon for hours. But he can't get out. He can't get free of the trap unless he gives up the seeds, which he doesn't want to do. Meanwhile, of course, the Zulus sneak up on him and nab him. It's the monkey's greed, you see, which catches him out in the end. So, as I mentioned, we're starting a short series today on giving and what it means to give financially, what our attitude to money should be. And the passage that Katie's just read to us from Luke 12 is a passage where Jesus is talking about greed, about human greed. Now, it's always good when we read a passage to work out what's been happening before that, so put it in a bit of context. So Jesus, if you look at the passage, is in the middle of a teaching session with his disciples. When he's interrupted by this guy who wants him to settle a difficult dispute with his brother. And as is often the case with disputes, it involves money. But Jesus won't be drawn. And he uses the question that the man throws at him to teach his disciples about the dangers of greed. But before that, there's part of a chapter where Jesus' concern is that his disciples are countercultural, against the culture of their time and age in their actions and attitudes. You see, at this very point in Jesus' ministry, there are two issues. Firstly, there's opposition from the religious leaders. So if we look back at verse 11, just above the start of verse 12, when Jesus went outside, the Pharisees and the teachers of the law began to oppose him fiercely and besiege him with questions, waiting to catch him in something he might say. So Jesus and his disciples were beginning to come under pressure, partly because Jesus has just berated the Pharisees for their hypocrisy. But it must have been really quite difficult. And, you know, maybe one or two of the disciples must have thought, gosh, is this worth the candle? Is that, you know, this is really quite difficult. Second problem, however, was almost the opposite, which was popular acclaim for Jesus. Because if we carry on reading into verse chapter 12, meanwhile, when a crowd of many thousands had gathered, so they were trampling on one another, Jesus began to speak to his disciples. Thousands were following Jesus. And this time the temptation would have been rather different, I suspect. The temptation for the disciples might be to lap up the crowd's favour, enjoy it, be pandered to it, sign the odd autograph. But at the heart of both problems, persecution and popular acclaim, there is the same temptation here. Wanting to be a people pleaser, wanting to go with the crowd, wanting to say the easiest thing that will get you out of the immediate problem. So it's at this point that Jesus addresses his disciples and warns them not to fall into that trap. Because the Pharisees really were just people pleasers in many ways. They were sham religious hypocrites who just played to the crowd. Be on your guard, says Jesus in verse 1. Be on your guard against the yeast of the Pharisees, which is hypocrisy. Don't be a people pleaser, he's saying. Fear God, not men. Don't seek man's approval, seek God's, he's saying. That's how a disciple of Jesus should act. And in fact, at the very end of chapter 12, Jesus says, seek God's kingdom and all these things will be given to you as well. Disciples of Jesus should fear God and seek first his kingdom. We need to be against the prevailing culture of the day, countercultural people. So given that context, it's a bit easier to see why Jesus answers the questioner in verse 13 in the way he does. He spots in this man a weakness which his disciples mustn't succumb to. Greed. For the disciples of Jesus are not to be rich unto themselves, but to God. So Jesus says, watch out! Be on your guard against all kinds of greed, because a man's life does not consist in the abundance of his possessions. Greed should be totally alien to Christians, because Christians should fear God first of all and seek first his kingdom. As Jesus says in verse 21, we are to be rich towards God first and foremost. And while this initial discussion in the parable and with this gentleman is around money and finances and possessions, greed affects many parts of our life, doesn't it? So as we read the passage and think about it, we need to examine our lives. Are we truly being rich towards God? Are we being countercultural in this area of our lives? Or have we ever so subtly fallen prey to the temptation of greed? Because if we fall short in this area, then it's clear that God's verdict on us will be, you fool, you fool. And that's not a verdict that any of us wish to hear. So here are three temptations which Jesus warns us against in this passage. Now, last time I had 3 points, and I didn't use slides, and I put them on a piece of paper. I have upgraded to slides this time, but they are quite dull slides. I'm just warning you, okay? There aren't pretty pictures, nothing moves. Right, but here's our first slide, our first point. Greed makes us get-centred rather than give-centred. Or put it another way, greed affects our attitude to others. Go back to the passage, verse 13. Someone in the crowd said to him, teacher, tell my brother to divide his inheritance with me. At first sight, you might think, nothing wrong with this man asking this question. It was the norm for people to ask rabbis like Jesus for help in settling family disputes. But Jesus is, of course, no ordinary rabbi, and he's not going to be drawn into a domestic. And one reason is that there is something far more important to be worried about, something about which this man has not understood. Because Jesus sees something in this man which leads him to take him to task and warn him publicly. For a start, the man butts into Jesus' teaching session without a care in the world. He's totally out of sync with what Jesus has been saying. Jesus has been impressing upon his hearers the need to fear God rather than men. But this oaf butts in and says, Jesus, sort out my domestic issue. He's not even particularly polite about it. Doesn't say, could you possibly give me a little help on this one? He says, tell my brother to divide the inheritance. Jesus sees inside the heart of this man to show that the man's real problem was not the injustice of being wronged, but the evil of greed. Watch out, says Jesus. Be on your guard against all kinds of greed. Why? Because a man's life does not consist in the abundance of his possessions. It's not wealth that's the problem, necessarily. It's the abundance of wealth. If our ring-tailed monkey had grabbed one or two seeds, he could have got his fist out of the melon. But greed means he grabs as many as he possibly can. And a greedy person always wants more and more, far more than they need. And when we are greedy for more, then we will do anything to get. And that was the problem for this man. He will do anything to get his share of the cash, even to the extent of climbing over his brother to do so. You and I know that greed ruins relationships. We can all think of families and friendships that have been ruined by greed, by arguments over money, because greed seriously affects our attitude to others. And this man is more get-centered than give-centered, because the more we have, the more sometimes we want. So in the case of one wealthy woman, she was a billionaire, and at one point she owned the Empire State Building. Yet in September 1989, Leona Hemsley was convicted of 33 counts of tax evasion, for which she faced the possibility of being sent to prison for 100 years. At her trial, it became clear that she was a penny-pinching tyrant who tried to get money out of everybody. No amount of money was too small to fight over. Her son had died at the age of 40 in 1982, and Hemsley sued and won the lion's share of his estate, leaving his four children with $400 each and his widow with $2,000. And what does Jesus say to us? Watch out. Beware of all types of greed, because greed simply uses and abuses people to get what we want. And it's very easy to fall into the trap. Even in the smallest ways, we can use and abuse people, often those we love, to get what we want and have it our way. Even Christians are prone to squabble over an inheritance from a relative. Even Christians will make sure they get what's due to us. Will kick and punch their way, metaphorically and maybe even literally, to get it. Watch out for all types of greed, said Jesus. So what are our weaknesses when it comes to greed? Maybe it's money. Maybe it's at work. Maybe we want a promotion at work to the detriment of others. Maybe we're greedy for friendship. Maybe we're greedy for a member of the opposite sex. Maybe we're greedy for someone or something we just cannot have that we desperately want. Maybe we're greedy for our grown-up children and family. Greedy is so destructive, it destroys relationships. And it's at this point that Jesus warns his disciples to be countercultural. Because when Christians go against the grain of popular culture in their contentment with their material possessions, then it makes an impact on the watching world around us. So greed makes us get-centered rather than give-centered. But it also makes us self-centered rather than God-centered. Self-centered rather than God-centered is another temptation that Jesus highlights. And Jesus then goes on to tell the parable. Jesus recognized a much deeper spiritual problem in this man's life, which was that his greed affected his attitude to God. He was far more interested in himself than God. Jesus told them this parable we read. The ground of a rich certain man produced a crop, and he thought to himself, "What shall I do? I have no place to store my crops. This is what I'll do. I'll tear down my barns and build bigger ones. There I will store up all my grain and my goods, and I'll say to myself, you have plenty of good things laid up for many years. Take life easy. Eat, drink, and be merry." I wonder what the man would have been like if he'd been around today. Perhaps he'd had a modest education, worked hard, done well, got a good degree perhaps, got a job in a junior as a junior clerk and then worked his way up. Oh, it had taken time and taken toll. But in his middle age, he was on top of the world. He had a lovely house in Kent. He bought a small yacht recently, which he sailed from time to time. His children loved their private schools and their expensive hobbies. His new gleaming Jaguar was sitting in the drive and everything was going well. So he decides to retire early. Oh, you're so wise, everybody would say to him, getting out of the rat race, putting your feet up, living off the fat of the land. But now the guests have gone. The party is over, and as he lies back in his pool, sipping his champagne, the sun setting behind the imported Japanese pagoda, he thinks to himself, you're a very lucky man. You've everything you've ever dreamed of. You've made it. Now all you need to do is to take life easy, eat, drink, and be merry. And suddenly, there is a searing pain in his chest, and he's dead before the ambulance can get to the house. Now to us, that man would have looked like the complete self-made man, a success in every sense of the world. A few blips on the way, but by and large he's a success. But what does God say? You fool. You fool, he's not wise at all, because he's not wealthy. The Bible isn't against wealth as such. The Bible doesn't criticise us because we save up and put money aside. In fact, the Bible encourages us to be prudent and wise with our possessions and money. Nothing wrong with early retirement or buying nice things. The reason the man is a fool is because he hasn't given God a second look. His world revolved around himself, and he thought that his life consisted in the abundance of his wealth. His motto was, "The boy with the most toys wins." When we go back to the passage and our man there, do you notice how self-centered he was? How many times the words I or me come in? He spends time talking to himself. In fact, he's even looking forward to the time when he'll be able to talk to himself in verse 19. His world revolved around him. His life told a story of being self-centered rather than God-centered. And he fails to even see that any of his wealth is God-given. In verse 16, the ground of a certain rich man produced a good crop. It's as if Jesus is subtly reminding us that for all our hard work, we are totally dependent on God's grace to make things grow and feed us. God alone gives us wealth and food and clothing. And yet this man totally failed to see it. And God's verdict? You fool. This is how it will be, says Jesus, with anyone who stores up things for himself but is not rich towards God. Jesus' point is very simple, isn't it? He's warning us that there's far more to life than getting as much as we can. Life has a different, far more important purpose, and that is to be rich towards God. As humans, we were designed to be in relationship with God, to enjoy and delight in him forever. And if we're not doing that, then we are missing out on the most important part of life. In fact, we've missed the entire point. We might be very successful. Successful as a family, successful in our jobs, successful making money. But if our life has no room for God, then we are a total fool. God has done amazing things for us. He has gone to extraordinary lengths to bring us into a relationship with him. We are natural rebels, aren't we? Natural rebels against God and facing eternity without him. But God, in his love, sent Jesus, his son, to die for us so that we could be right with God again. He became poor so that we could be truly rich, not having more toys than anyone else, but able to be rich towards God. And if we're ignoring God at the moment, then we're fools. And let's not forget that context we talked about. Who's Jesus talking to here? Talking to his disciples. He's warning his disciples to be countercultural. So for those of us who are Christians, we need to hear this challenge loud and clear. We need to make sure that we are not rich towards self, but we are rich towards God. We need to not worry about our material wealth, but to trust God. We need to be using our wealth for God's kingdom and his purposes. But of course, the temptation is so often to do the other, to be self-centered rather than God-centered. We need to wise up. Let me just perhaps give a small illustration on money. Very difficult thing to talk about. Joe and I have just been on holiday to America. And one of the big cultural differences that those of you who have been to America will know is around tipping. Now, in Britain, we find tipping a bit awkward, don't we? We never know how much to give. We never know what we should give. And we just harumph about it a bit. In America, they are completely not embarrassed about tipping. It is absolutely expected in certain occasions. And in fact, if you pay for a meal or something like that with a card, you put your card in, and then it comes up with, you know, how much your meal is, and then different amounts of tip that you can give, and you click one of them. I think if you scroll down, it probably says none of the above, but that's a bit embarrassing. I heard someone once say that when they began attending church, they would throw some money into the offering plate every Sunday. It wasn't until later they realised they'd been tipping God, not tithing. So let me explain. We tip waiters and others who perform a service for us. But in Malachi, God's word says, bring the whole tithe or tenth of your income into the storehouse, that there may be food in my house. Now, I'm not going to talk today about whether tithing is the right or wrong amount. That's for you and us to work out. But we are certainly not meant to tip God when we have a few extra pounds. I've had a good week, God. I'll throw an extra tenner into the plate. Thank you for that answer to prayer, God. Here's 20 quid. We're not to give God a bit extra when we're feeling flush. But we are to give to him and his work in a spirit-filled, generous, and thought-through way. And then finally, and briefly, get centered rather than give centered. Wealth makes us self-centered rather than God-centered. And then finally, greed rather makes us now-centered rather than future-centered. Because greed affects our relationship to time. The man in the parable was a fool for many reasons, not only because he forgot about his relationship with God, but because he thought he had all the time in the world. He thought he'd live to enjoy his hard-earned cash, but he wasn't. He only had a few hours to live, and that's why Jesus is so urgent in this parable. He knows the reality and fragility of life. We are like flowers in the field, here today and gone tomorrow. But too many of us often live our lives as if we were in charge of our destinies, as if we know exactly what will happen. We centre far too much on the now rather than the future. We forget that the most important event in our lives will not be exams, not be the degree to come, not be the success of our family or our jobs, not be our children or grandchildren. No, it'll be the great final examination before God on Judgment Day, the one we really need to be ready for. And if we've invested all our time in the present world without a thought for what happens next, then we are total fools according to Jesus. We mustn't postpone thinking about Christianity, thinking, I've got all the time in the world. Life for each one of us is too short. So, will we live for the present or the future? Will we be rich towards ourselves or towards God? The joy of the world to come should spur us on to serve God joyfully and faithfully, knowing that every minute counts when we invest in the kingdom of heaven. So we need to use every day, don't we? Every hour for the glory of God. We need to make sure that greed in all its forms does not hamstring our Christian life. We need to make sure that we're not get-centered, but give-centered. That we are not self-centered, but God-centered. And that we are not present-centered, but future-centered. That's the choice we face today. Let's ask for God's grace as we seek to follow him in this area. Amen. We're going